Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
By fall of 2022, the Summit County Sheriff's investigation into Eric's death had stalled. Deputy Jamie Woody testified to that. Meanwhile, Gabler had already identified Carmen Lauber, flagged her drug court history, started feeding the sheriff's office information that they didn't have. The flow went one direction for Eric's family, that gap between what Gabler was finding and what law enforcement was doing with it wasn't very abstract. It was whether anyone would ever be ever held accountable as the main question there. Todd is with us today. Todd Gabler, the private investigator for Eric Richens and his family, the man you saw during the trial testifying. He is with us today to continue this conversation, breaking down his findings in this case. Carmen Lauber, we're at this point entering into the story, and the cast of characters that come along with Carmen Lauber. Obviously, you saw a lot of communications between Carmen and Corey via the devices and such. What was standing out to you? Why did that flag you? She was a housekeeper. There was somewhat of a relationship there, but what made you go, this seems like there could be something deeper?
Couple of things. First of all, Carmen was close to Eric and the boys. Mm-hmm. She liked them. She was inside the house, cleaning the house. But she is conspicuously absent from Eric's memorial service. This was noticed by the family and friends in attendance. I considered this possible evidence of consciousness of guilt. The second thing was the criminal history, which was as substantial a criminal history as I have seen in my many years of investigations. There was a lot, and I was very concerned. And I notified the sheriff's office of my concern in May of 2022. For anyone who is continuing this line of argument that Corey and her supporters make, that the sheriff's office was simply doing what I told them to do, look at this fact. I told them to go talk to Carmen Lauber because she would likely be compliant with law enforcement and not me. Mm-hmm. That she had a dirty urinalysis around the time of Eric's death and that she was on the ropes in drug court. Mm-hmm. I thought that this was a perfect opportunity for law enforcement to talk to Carmen Lauber. They talked to Carmen Lauber a year later, April of 2023. So anybody thinks that I was pulling the Summit County Sheriff's Office around by the nose, they're wrong. And this is one example of that. I told them to talk to Carmen, and I purposely did not talk with Carmen. I certainly had the ability and the opportunity to do that, but I wanted the police to do that because they had a much greater leverage to get her to come clean about this. And I thought that it would be appropriate for them to do that without any suggestion that I had prompted her, coerced her, suggested what she had to say. I have to this day not spoken with Carmen Lauber. Mm-hmm. Nothing that she says or does has anything to do with the Richens family or with me. And let me also add here parenthetically, I do not speak for the Richens family. Mm-hmm. I do not speak for the estate. I speak for myself. I was not in the employ of the Richens family or the estate at the time that I testified. A lot of people have suggested that I was being paid for my testimony at that trial. That is false. Mm-hmm. I was under subpoena by the state of Utah, and they don't pay witnesses. Yeah. So I was the only professional in that courtroom who was not paid. And as far as I can remember, it's the only homicide trial I have attended where I have not been paid.
Sure. So,
you know, I just want to be clear about that.
No, I appreciate that. It's good to clear that up. So when people are going down their rabbit holes or their accusations, it's good to hear it from the source. The fact that it took them a year to go talk to Carmen Lauber, when you're looking at this in hindsight now that the case, you know, that she's, you know, away, she's got her verdict. What runs through your mind? What was going on in this investigation? I know you can't read the minds of law enforcement, but in your own opinion, what was going on here? Why did it take so long for them to dig to where they needed to dig? Is it just kind of one of those things of not enough resources? Is there something going on here? They didn't want to dig into it. I don't know. I'm not trying to insert answers or words into anyone's mouths, but what do you think was going on here? Because it is kind of baffling.
Well, my answer is total speculation.
Yeah, sure.
I think that Summit County does not see a lot of homicides.
Yeah.
I think that it is a matter of experience. And I had more experience than they did with these matters. And I think that also there was a... there was a gentleman who did all the computer and cell phone forensics for the sheriff's office, who's there for a number of years. And Ron, all I can remember is his name is Ron. I think that's right. Very qualified, but probably the only guy that was doing that work inside the sheriff's office. And when he left to go on to other things, I think that that left a pretty large vacuum. Now, to be fair to the sheriff's office, they have stood up a very impressive forensic examination program within the sheriff's office. There's a new sheriff in town, quite literally. Sheriff Bates is the new Summit County sheriff, and she is a very smart and capable person who I think will bring new and vital blood to the sheriff's office going forward in investigations. So, you know, to speculate about why they didn't approach Carmen for over a year, I'll leave that for them to answer. But suffice to say that when I detected that they were not going to speak with Carmen or had not spoken with her, I continued my investigation of Carmen, which became intense. Mm-hmm. I was video recording the comings and goings at her house. I was attempting to track vehicles that she may be using. I was monitoring the people coming in and out of that house. I was keenly interested in what was going on with Carmen Lauber. And that eventually, I think, encouraged them to take a closer look. What eventually prompts them to go talk to Carmen, it's probably a mix of a new detective is assigned to the case in the spring of 2023, and Corey publishes a book. Mm-hmm. She publishes a book. It is it's probably what catapults this case into the stratosphere with respect to its visibility. Mm-hmm. But it is also part of the psychopathology of Corey that she is manipulating this situation for her own benefit. She is doing it to bring attention to herself as a victim. And she is portraying herself, woe is me. But she's using her children to do that. And treating her children as objects is Corey's MO.
Yes.
This is what she does. And this is the first example we get to see of the public exploitation of her children. It is, it's part of her psychopathology.
Very much so. Yeah.
And there are other objectifications and manipulations of the children that occur. But I think the publishing of this book probably wakes people up inside of Summit County as to, whoa, wait. What? She's done what now?
Why do you think, why did she write the damn book? Did she feel like the walls might be closing in on her from behind the scenes that people were starting to? Or was it just that pathology of the narcissist, borderline, or sociopath, or whatever weird combination of all the above she has, where she couldn't help herself? Because it feeds that itch, that need for the attention and the grandiosity, while at the same time controlling the narrative.
Right. Well, that's a lot. You've said a lot there. Yeah. There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
I think that it is manipulative. Mm-hmm. I think that it manipulates the storyline. She is profoundly needing of control. She wants to control the narrative. And as 2023 comes around, she realizes by the police focusing on a number of different things in her life, I am also circling around her, talking with people in her life. She realizes she's losing control of this narrative, and she's got to regain that control. So she publishes this book, a book that she could not write herself because she does not have the emotions that are necessary to write a book about grief. She cannot emote. She cannot understand. And therefore, this is a compensation mechanism for her to control emotions that she cannot herself have. Mm-hmm. So if she can create this object of emotion and hire someone to write about emotions that she cannot understand. This is the reason for the ghostwriter, because she can't understand these emotions. She doesn't understand the emotions of others. She cannot feel them in the same way that we do. So she has someone write a book about it so that she can hold that out and say, see, I understand these emotions. I'm feeling all of these things, but it's a smoke. It's a smokescreen. It is not emotion that she can truly understand. And all you have to do is look at her sentencing elocution, this rambling screed that is a narcissistic, psychopathic blueprint. This sentencing it really shows her true colors, her lack of empathy, her shallow emotions, her lack of remorse, her resistance to punishment, all of these things that are part of the homicidal psychopath are on display during this sentencing. And one of those things is this lack of ability to have an emotional response to the emotions of others.
Yeah.
It is, there's zero affect for her children. You see that not just in the sentencing, but in that body cam video, which I think was wonderfully parsed by a YouTuber in Canada. I can't remember the name of it right now, and I'm sorry that I can't. She breaks down what Corey is doing in that video. And it is 30 minutes into that video before she talks about her children.
Mm-hmm.
She does not go to comfort her children on that body cam.
Yeah.
Not once. She does not exhibit appropriate emotional affect. And I know there's this criticism about you can't judge the way a person grieves, but the abject lack of appropriate emotion, first of all, she's simulating crying the whole time but she's hiding what she can't do.
Mm-hmm.
She's hiding the fact that she can't cry. She cries through her nose during the trial and during the sentencing. She cries from here. That's a stress response. That's not true emotion. She's not crying from here. The only time you see in all of the video in this case, and God knows there has been a ton of it, you do not see tears coming out of her eyes. The only thing she can manage at the sentencing is some moisture around the edge where you see the mascara smear, but that is in response to her loss of freedom. Yeah. That is in response to her enablers, her family members, talking about their loss of their ability to see her outside of a jail or a prison. That's all that's about. There's no actual emotional affect for the loss of her husband, the father of her children, the enormous, enormous damage that she has done to her children, the enormous damage that she's done to the Richens family, to everybody around the Richens family and that business that Eric ran so successfully with his business partner. None of that prompts emotion from her. So, you know, I think that what we see now is, now that you can see what I knew during this investigation, the public can now see the true homicidal psychopath that she is. I don't know why it's so difficult for us to say those words. We can talk about narcissism and borderline personality disorder, but we can't say that Corey is a homicidal psychopath. I'm here to say the words. Yeah. She's a homicidal psychopath. Maybe we don't want to say those words because we're not clinicians, and that's a and that's a clinical assessment. But I submit to you that we can look at the public record in this case and know that she is a pathological liar. She does the lying for material gain. There is a laundry list. I developed a shortcut to this and to determine when Corey was lying. It's this: her mouth is open and words are coming out.
Scientific.
That's
true.
Profound lack of empathy.
Yeah.
She has shallow emotions. She exhibits manipulative behavior. Yeah. She has a superficial charm. A lot of people don't understand this. Psychopaths are very charming.
Yeah.
I've sat next to more than my share of psychopaths in a courtroom, in a jail, outside of those things. And I can tell you that they are very charming.
Yep.
Why? Because they need to overcome the deficit that they know they have, that they cannot truly empathize with the emotions of others. So they develop skills to ensnare the empathic people amongst us. They prey upon the empathic because those are the people that they can exploit with their superficial charm, her lack of remorse, her need for control. The calculated violence in this case is clear. The calculation was multiple times. It took a long time for her to calculate this and to cross the Rubicon of homicide. A lot of psychopaths never commit homicide. There's a lot of psychopaths amongst us, and they don't all become murderers. But the calculated violence, the resistance to punishment, the fantasies of success and power, all of these things are hallmarks of the psychopath. She checks every single box, and she does so profoundly.
She does, without a doubt. Todd Gabler is with us. We're breaking down the Corey Richens case. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
We've been talking about this case for literally about 3 years, since we started this program is when a lot of this went down. And we've analyzed every angle of this thing, from her innocence to her guilt. We all know what the facts say now. So it's interesting to go back down those paths that we once visited, where we speculated on innocence or guilt, and see where the blocks have been put into place now and what that structure looks like factually, now that we have more of a definitive answer as to what was truly going on with Corey Richens and Eric Richens and their children and those around leading up to her conviction in court earlier in the year. It's going to be fascinating. So if you've been watching this story, if you've been following along, or maybe you've heard bits and pieces and you're like, I really want to grasp this whole damn thing. This is a place to do. This is part one in our 5-part series that we're going to break down the whole case, all of it, start to finish, who these people are, who they were, and what drove them to do what they did. All the pieces working together in some sort of hellish harmony that created what it did. And as we do, I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Those links are in the description. In April of 2023, a woman sat on the set of Good Things Utah, a local morning show in Salt Lake City, and talked about grief. She was poised. She was sympathetic. She had prepared talking points about how to help children cope with losing a parent. Even had a promo code, so viewers could buy her self-published children's book, Are You With Me? She told the hosts she wrote the book with her kids to help them process the unexpected death of their father. The oldest was 10. She said it brought a little peace to her and her boys. And look, I mean, if that's authentic and real, yeah, I mean, that's, wow. That's a really interesting way, and it sounds like effective way at working through grief with your kids and helping them through it and bonding at the same time. She described the past year as an exercise in survival, navigating first holidays, anniversaries, birthdays, all without the man that she'd married. The only problem is she didn't write the book with her kids or herself, even. A ghostwriter did. For $2,500. And in a text message to her brother, she admitted the book was really just practice, something to help her understand the book writing process to get ready for the big one. You know, like gymnasts do when they go to children's playgrounds and play on monkey bars before they get on the big ones and swing around and throw people up in the air with no net. Oh, wait, that's not how that works. Just like having a ghostwriter create a children's mainly illustrative picture book is somehow an exercise in getting you to writing a novel. Yeah, that makes sense, Corey. But as you'll learn, the through line through this story, as it is in so many of the stories, dumbass is certainly there. And lying narcissist is also a big through line in this story. And as I say on all cases, narcissism always wins. Without fail, narcissism always wins. But Tony, she's going away for the rest of her life. You're right. You know why? Narcissism won. It took over her. It took over her life. It took over her thinking. It took over everything that she does, and it won. It destroyed her. That is what narcissism does. It doesn't make the narcissist win. No, they're the ones who always lose. At the end of the day, when all is said and done, it falls apart. It goes to shit. It's the end when it's the end. Usually far earlier than it needs to be for the narcissists. But the destruction that they create practicing the narcissism, it certainly has its effect, and it takes its course, and this one certainly has. The children's book about her dead husband, the husband she killed, was a dress rehearsal for a bigger payday. That woman was Corey Richens, and the performance she gave on that morning show was just the last in a long series of performances that defined her entire adult life. Every smile was calculated, every tear was optional, and the grief she performed so convincingly on camera was the same grief she manufactured in a $2,500 purchase order to a ghostwriter. Like I said, this is part one of her five-part series, the definitive Corey Richens story. Hi, Corey, as you're watching us from a jail cell, I know she is. Why? Because narcissists can't get enough of their own publicity, even if it's shitty. Hope it works out well for you. Heard they got Skittles at the commissary every Wednesday. Better save your pennies. We're going to tell your story start to finish. You probably are not going to want to continue because this is, you might get a narcissistic injury, Corey. You don't want to stub your big toe. That might hurt a little bit. Be stubbing more than that, by the way. Over the next five episodes, we're going to be taking this case apart piece by piece. The fraud that built her empire, the affair, and the fentanyl that fueled her plan. The night she mixed that final drink, the 14-month cover-up she staged from a TV studio to a jail cell, and the verdict that ended it all. No other coverage has told the story in this sort of way. We're going to be starting at the foundation, who Corey Richens really was before she ever became a defendant, because context is important. And as you know, we like getting deep into the psychology of the people we talk about on this show. So, on March 16th, 2026, a jury in Summit County, Utah, convicted Corey Richens of aggravated murder, attempted aggravated murder, forgery, and two counts of insurance fraud in connection with the death of her husband, Eric Richens. They deliberated for less than 3 hours. She bowed her head when the verdict was read. She faces 25 years to life in prison or life without the possibility of parole. But to understand how a suburban mother of three ended up sitting in a courtroom hearing, the word guilty repeated five times, you have to understand the mask she wore long before she ever mixed that final drink. Because the murder wasn't where this story started. The murder was where the mask finally cracked. Corey Darden. Yes, Darden before Richens, her maiden name, grew up in Utah. Her father went to prison. Her mother was an alcoholic. She grew up cleaning houses for wealthy families in Park City, scrubbing toilets, making beds, watching other people live the kind of life she wanted. And she told herself one day she'd own those homes. That ambition by itself isn't a character flaw. Plenty of people come from nothing and build something real through hard work and discipline and the kind of resilience that adversity sometimes forges. I get it. But Corey didn't build. She performed. She created the appearance of success. While the foundation underneath was made of fraud, forgery, and someone else's money. She wanted the lifestyle without the substance, the reputation without the track record, the wealth without the work. Let's meet Eric Richens, a man who had everything she wanted to project. Eric co-owned CNE Masonry, a successful stonemasonry business that he'd built with his own hands. He was an outdoorsman, a hunter, a cattleman, the kind whose obituary would describe him as dedicated to his family and happiest with dirt under his fingernails. He had real money, real stability, and a real reputation in the community that came from years of honest work. His sisters described him as a man who loved his boys fiercely, who coached them, hunted with them, who was building a life centered around them, not around image or status. He was the kind of father who showed up, the kind of husband who, even when his marriage was failing, stayed for his children because he believed that's what a man does. When he finally realized how dangerous Corey was, he didn't run. He built a legal fortress around his kids. That's who Eric Richens was. Not a footnote in a murder case, a person, a father, a man who deserved to watch his boys grow up. They married on June 15th of 2013 in the backyard of their home in Utah. They already had one son together. Two more would follow. And on their wedding day, they signed a document that would become the most important piece of evidence in a murder trial 13 years later, a prenuptial agreement. The terms were straightforward. Neither party had rights to each other's present or future income, property, or assets. If they divorced, they walked away with what they came in with. Corey came in with nothing, which meant she'd leave with nothing. But there was one exception buried in the language, a single clause that would change everything. If Eric died while they were lawfully married, Corey would inherit his estate, his business, his properties, his accounts, everything. Divorce equaled zero. Death equaled millions. The clause wasn't a legal technicality. It was a loaded weapon sitting in a filing cabinet. And Corey knew exactly where it was. She'd signed it, she'd agreed to it, and at some point she decided to use it. For a few years, the marriage looked functional enough from the outside. They had three boys, lived in Comus, Utah, a quiet mountain town about 40 miles southeast of Salt Lake City. Not far from the ski resort culture of Park City, Eric ran his masonry business. Corey projected the image of a busy, ambitious wife and mother. Friends described them as having what appeared to be a comfortable life. But comfortable wasn't enough for Corey. She didn't want comfort. She wanted status. She wanted the version of success she'd seen growing up in other people's houses, the kind that comes with a big address and a bigger reputation. Eric's steady blue-collar prosperity wasn't the life she'd imagined for herself, and so in 2019, she decided to build her own empire. That's when the cracks became canyons. K. Richens Realty was a house flipping business. The concept was simple. Buy properties, renovate them, sell them for profit. Looks super easy on HGTV. In real life, the execution's a little more complex. Just a little. The execution was catastrophic. To fund it, Corey took out a $250,000 home equity line of credit against the family home, but she didn't tell her husband. She didn't tell Eric. You know, who bought the home with his money. Prosecutors allege she used his power of attorney to take out the HELOC without his knowledge, putting the roof over their children's head on the line so she could fund a business she had no demonstrated ability to manage. Eric's brother-in-law, Clint Benson, testified that when Eric eventually found out about the HELOC, he was very upset and sad. Benson said they discussed divorce attorneys that same day. That's the point at which Eric Richens began trying to protect himself from his own wife. And that protection would ultimately prove to be both very persistent and heartbreaking. The business grew faster than Corey could control it. One property in 2019 became 15 simultaneous renovation projects by 2021, totaling more than $6.7 million in real estate purchases. She was juggling contractors, lenders, timelines, and budgets on a scale that would challenge a seasoned developer with a full team and deep pockets. Corey was neither seasoned nor solvent. She was a woman with ambition, no guardrails, and a dangerous willingness to bet other people's money on her own optimism and lack of experience. The numbers tell the story better than any narrative ever could. Between January of 21 and March of 2022, Corey attempted 236 overdraft transactions, more than $300,000 in bounced checks written to contractors who'd done work for her in good faith. Her business account racked up nearly $6,000 in fees just from rejected transactions. She tried to pay herself $60,000 and the transaction was rejected because the account was empty. She lost over $900,000 across the properties she managed to sell. When you subtract contractor costs, closing fees, and carrying expenses. By the time Eric died in March of 2022, forensic accountant Brooke Carrington testified that Corey owed approximately $7.5 million in total debt and was paying roughly $80,000 per month to her lenders. Carrington told the jury that Corey's financial enterprise was collapsing and had been collapsing, and but for a significant confusion of cash and capital, would have continued to collapse. She used a word that stuck: imploding. If Corey had sold everything she owned, Carrington said, it would have not been enough to get back to zero. And here's where the prenup re-enters the picture. Corey was drowning. Her business was hemorrhaging money faster than she could borrow it. Her contractors were getting bounced checks. Her lenders were circling. She couldn't leave Eric because the prenup guaranteed she'd walk away with nothing. She couldn't stay and keep pretending because the facade was cracking and Eric was starting to notice exactly where his money was going. She was trapped in a marriage she needed financially but couldn't sustain personally, in a business that was consuming her faster than she could feed it. And the only exit that actually paid was the one written into her wedding contract. Eric Richens was not a man who missed things forever. In fall of 2020, he discovered the scope of what Corey had been doing with his finances. He found the unauthorized HELOC. He found spending he hadn't approved. He discovered debt she'd been accumulating in his name and against his assets, debt he never authorized and didn't know existed. And he did something that in hindsight may have been the bravest and most consequential decision of his life. He quietly went to see a divorce attorney. Then he went to see an estate planning lawyer named Crystal Bowman Carter. Bowman Carter's testimony at the trial was devastating in its simplicity. He said Eric came to her with two goals. First, he wanted to protect himself from fairly recently discovered and ongoing abuse and misuse of his finances by his wife. Second, he wanted to protect his three sons by ensuring Corey would never be in a position to manage his property after his death. Eric created the Eric Richens Living Trust. He named his sister Katie Richen Benson as trustee. He removed Corey as a beneficiary of his $500,000 life insurance policy. He transferred his home and business interests into the trust. He did all of this without telling Corey a single thing because the man she married no longer trusted her with his money, his legacy, or his children's future. He was building a firewall between his family and his wife, and he didn't even tell her it existed. But Corey didn't know. She had no idea that the estate she was counting on, the one the prenup was supposed to guarantee her if Eric died, had been placed beyond her reach. She was still operating under the assumption that death equaled inheritance, that the prenup was her golden ticket, that if Eric stopped breathing, she'd start living the life she'd been performing for years. She'd done the math. She looked at the insurance policies. She looked at the estate. She looked at the debt. And she decided that the only number that made everything work was zero. Eric Richens's pulse. Prosecutor Brad Bloodworth framed it in his closing arguments with a line that should follow this case into every textbook, every podcast, every conversation about what happens when narcissism meets financial desperation. Corey Richens is an intensely ambitious person. She is a risk taker. There was a way forward. Eric had to die. That is who Corey Richens was before the murder, before the fentanyl, before the Moscow mule, before the children's book and the TV appearance and the jail cell letter and the Google searches she couldn't even spell correctly. She was a woman who built a life on borrowed money and forged signatures, who projected an image of success while the real numbers were catastrophic, and who had exactly one exit strategy left. Eric Richens wasn't her husband. He was the insurance policy. And when he tried to protect himself and his children from her, She didn't adjust. She didn't come clean. She didn't accept that the game was over. She accelerated her plan to cash him in. The mask was flawless. The woman underneath it was not. In part two, we followed the plan, the secret affair, the forged insurance policies, the fentanyl. She bought at a gas station through her housekeeper, and a Valentine's Day poisoning attempt that should have been the warning nobody could ignore. Eric Richens told his family, if anything happens to me, she did it. Oh, nobody stopped her in time. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We're going to continue to work through this. Part two is coming up next. I don't want you to miss it. If you want to get at it right now, you can. There's a couple options for you. You can become a member on our YouTube channel. Link is in the description. You can get it also through Apple Podcasts if you become a member there as well. You get advanced episodes ad-free. So do indeed check that out. Again, links are in the description. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
On the night of March 3rd, 2022, Robert Josh Grossman sent Corey Richens a GIF image. Two people kissing, captioned, "Love you." She texted back, "Love you." Then she went to the kitchen and mixed her husband a cocktail. Within hours, Eric Richens was dead in their bed with five times a lethal dose of fentanyl in his blood. The only people in the house were Corey, Eric, and their three young sons. The boyfriend got a good night, "Love you," text. The husband got a Moscow mule. And that's not a crime of passion. That's not a woman who snapped under pressure. That's a woman who had a plan, a timeline, and a checklist, and she'd been working through it for months, maybe longer. Welcome to part two. In our five-part definitive series on the Corey Richens case, in part one, we stripped off the mask, the $7.5 million in debt, the prenup that made death more profitable than divorce, and the financial empire that was imploding beneath her feet. Now we get to the mechanics of how she planned to kill her husband, the affair, the insurance, the drugs, and the rehearsal that almost worked. Almost. To understand the plan, you have to understand the affair. Robert Josh Grossman was a military veteran from South Carolina. He'd met Corey years earlier when he answered a help wanted ad for one of her house flipping projects out of state. They communicated on and off for years after that. In 2020, he moved across the country to Utah and began living in houses Corey was renovating. He worked as her handyman. He was paid infrequently, and what he described on the stand as lump sums. There was no written contract. He was financially dependent on her, living in her properties, eating at her table, existing within a structure that she controlled. And at some point, he became her lover. "Tell me again, can you be my contractor that I don't pay any money to and have you do everything for me while I'm married to my husband and I'm slowly poisoning him and friends?" Didn't work out for the Usher song. The lyrics were just, it was too much. You're like, it's a bit much. The text message between Corey and Grossman, displayed for the jury during the trial, painted a picture of a woman who had already left her marriage emotionally and was mapping out a future that didn't include her husband being alive. In December of 21, 3 months before Eric Richens died, Corey texted Grossman, "If I divorced right now and asked you to marry me tomorrow, would you?" She talked about collecting millions and divorce and one day marrying Grossman. She told him she really enjoyed their relationship and acknowledged the love triangle can't go on forever. She said, you don't deserve it. I don't deserve you. I can't expect you to sit around for the day the trigger gets pulled. The trigger? Her word? Not mine. She texted him about purchasing properties in Park City, telling him it was a huge deal because she grew up scrubbing toilets for wealthy people there and had promised herself she'd own those homes someday. She was confiding in her boyfriend about the ambition that was driving everything, ambition or delusion, depending on who's playing along at home. The spending, the debt, the fraud, and ultimately, the murder. Grossman got emotional on the stand. He wiped his eyes repeatedly. He put his head down and muttered, oh boy, as the private messages lit up the courtroom screen. The judge offered him a break. He said he loved her and believed she loved him. But he also testified that he never, not for a single moment, suspected that Eric's death was anything other than a tragedy. About 2 weeks before Eric died, Corey took Grossman to the United Mountains. They talked for hours. At some point, she asked him if he'd ever killed anyone while serving in Iraq. Then she asked how it made him feel. At the time, he thought she was emotionally exhausted and trying to shift the conversation away from herself. Looking back after her arrest, that question landed a little differently. It wasn't until Corey was in handcuffs that he contacted Eric's family through their private investigator and started re-examining everything with different eyes. He told the jury he was overwhelmed with guilt and sorrow, not for the murder, but for the affair, for being part of something he didn't understand until it was too late. The affair was one column of the plan. The other was money, and Corey had been building that column for years with the patience of someone who thinks in timelines, not impulses. Between 2015 and 2017, prosecutors presented evidence that Corey secretly purchased at least four life insurance policies on Eric's life without his knowledge, totaling $1.9 million. She was listed as the beneficiary on all of them. She didn't tell Eric about any of them. A forensic document specialist who examined one of the policies, a $100,000 policy that went into effect in early 2022, testified that Eric's signature on the application was probably forged. The application also contained his incorrect social security number, which prosecutors argued demonstrated that Corey, not Eric, had filled it out. Then, in January 22, just 2 months before Eric's death, Corey made herself the beneficiary of yet another policy, a $2 million life insurance policy that Eric held jointly with his business partner. The insurance company flagged the charge and alerted Eric directly. He switched it back to his business partner, but the attempt tells you everything you need to know about Corey's mindset in those final months. She was reaching for every dollar she could attach to his death. She was stacking policies like a poker player loading chips before an all-in bet, and the bet was her husband's life. In total, Eric's life was insured for about $2.2 million across multiple policies. After he died, Corey collected about $1.4 million in payouts. The rest went to a trust she didn't yet know existed. Forensic accountant Brooke Carrington testified that the insurance money didn't last long. Corey used roughly $600,000 to pay down some of her debts. She gave $25,000 to Grossman. The rest evaporated into the same financial black hole that had been swallowing everything else. The $1.4 million she collected from her husband's death couldn't even cover the debt she accumulated, trying to impress people she'd never be. So the affair was in place, the insurance policies were stacked, the debt was catastrophic and accelerating, and the prenuptial agreement meant that divorce would leave Corey with nothing, while death would leave her with everything. Or so she believed. And that was missing. All that was missing in this equation here, a weapon. And for that, Corey Richens turned to her housekeeper, Carmen Lauber, she cleaned houses for the Richens family. She also had a criminal history involving drug possession and distribution. How convenient. And in late January or early February of 22, Corey called her with what she framed as a favor. She said she had an investor who needed pain pills. Could Lauber reach out to someone? Lauber testified that she said she'd see what she could do. She bought an envelope of opiate pills from a woman she worked with and gave them to Corey in her driveway the next morning. That was the first transaction. And it wouldn't be the last. Corey told Lauber her investor wanted something stronger. Lauber texted back that she had a contact who could get fentanyl pills. Corey's response, according to Lauber's testimony, okay, go ahead and get it, not what is fentanyl, not is that safe, just go ahead and get it. Prosecutors said Corey referred to what she wanted as the Michael Jackson stuff because she knew Michael Jackson died from taking drugs and she wanted the same outcome. She didn't know the pharmacology. She didn't know the street names. She didn't know how to navigate the world of illicit drugs, but she knew she wanted something lethal. And she said so. By the way, Michael Jackson died of propofol overdose, not this. But again, the words don't matter. The modality does. When you're asking for the Michael Jackson stuff, nobody's going, oh, the stuff that gets you up on stage and moonwalks? No, the stuff that kills you in your bed. That's what she wanted, and that's what she got. Lauber bought pills from a man named Robert Krauser at a Maverick gas station in Draper, Utah. On February 11th, 2022, cell phone location data presented at trial confirmed both Lauber and Krauser's phones were near a gas station that day. Corey paid Lauber $1,000. Then before the month was over, Corey asked again, something stronger still. Lauber went back to Krauser around February 26. Cell phone records again confirmed both phones near the gas station. Corey paid another $1,000. Each transaction documented by digital breadcrumbs that neither woman bothered to hide because neither of them imagined it would matter. 10 days after the first fentanyl purchase from Krauser, Corey Richens made her husband a sandwich on Valentine's Day. After taking a bite, Eric broke out in hives. He couldn't breathe. He grabbed his son's EpiPen and used it on himself. He took Benadryl and laid down. He called two friends to tell them what happened. One of them, his business partner, Cody Wright, said Eric had fear in his voice. A quality, Wright said he'd almost never heard from the man. His friend Josh Craze said Eric was somber and very serious. Eric told them what he believed was happening. His wife was trying to poison him. Some of his friends treated the story like a scary antidote. Allie Staking, one of Corey's friends, testified the group laughed about it at the same time, thinking it was an allergic reaction. Ha ha! But Eric wasn't laughing. His family testified that Eric told him something chilling in the weeks before his death. If anything ever happened to him, he said Corey was to blame. He said it directly. He said it clearly. That is not speculation. That's not hindsight. That's a man telling his own family that his wife might do this to him and then dying exactly the way he predicted in exactly the time frame he feared. And Valentine's Day wasn't even the first attempt. Years earlier, during a family trip to Greece, Eric became violently ill after drinking something Corey gave him. He called his sister from overseas and told her he believed his wife had tried to kill him. The jury convicted Corey of attempted aggravated murder for the Valentine's Day incident. The Greece incident wasn't charged separately, but it painted the picture prosecutors wanted the jury to see: a woman who tried, failed, recalibrated, and tried again, and again, and again, until it worked. That's the part of this case that strips away any defense of impulse or accident. Corey Richens didn't make one terrible decision in a moment of crisis. She made a series of calculated decisions over weeks and months and possibly years. She cultivated a drug connection through her housekeeper. She asked for pills, the stronger pills, then the most lethal thing available. She tried food. When that failed, she waited. She She procured more. And then the night of March 3rd, 2022, she decided the Moscow Mule would be the final delivery method, or so she hoped. Prosecutor Bloodworth told the jury, she learned from her mistake on Valentine's Day. This time she wouldn't give him food, she'd give him a drink. And she'd make sure the dose was so overwhelming, there was no EpiPen, no hospital visit, no second chance. Five times a lethal dose. Bloodworth's words to the jury. She wanted Eric not only dead, but good and dead. As of the evening of March 3rd, winds down. The affair is at full tilt. The insurance policies are in place. The fentanyl has been purchased and repurchased. The boyfriend has sent his goodnight text. The husband has no idea that the drink in his hand is the last thing he'll ever taste. And the woman who mixed it has already done the math. She knows what the prenup says. She knows what the policies are worth. She's calculated the debt she can erase, the life she can start. She's texted, "Love you," to one man and poured a drink for another. And in her mind, those two actions are not contradictory. They're complementary. The text is about the future. The drink is about making that future possible. All that's left is the execution. And by morning, Eric Richens will be cold in his own bed. And Corey Richens will be calling 911 with a voice calibrated to sound like shock. In part three, we reconstruct that night, the Moscow Mule, the 911 call, the 3:08 a.m., and the 72 hours that followed. The hours in which Corey closed on a mansion, drilled open Eric's safe, and punched his sister in the face when she learned she'd been cut from his will. The mask doesn't just crack, it shatters. Press subscribe so you don't miss that. That is coming up next in our series. We're dropping a brand new one every single day for you here on the channel this week. Five parts breaking down the full Corey Richens story in its entirety in one place as we approach her sentencing. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love to see them there. We'll continue our conversation there as well. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.